good hands. I want to take this opportunity to give great thanks and appreciation as a non-board member to members of the board, not just my brother, though he deserves great credit as well, who have stepped forward in the past 2 years and made the decision to, in someone's immortal words, seize the time. They have set themselves a daunting task to turn the NCRRC to a new purpose, which was the original purpose, to seek redress for a crime committed against our family and against our country by the U.S. government back in the 1950s. This is not an easy task, and I commend each and every one of them for it, and thank you who are here tonight for your continuing support. Thank you, Michael Miropol. Okay, now I'm back as the MC. And now we will have a short presentation by Jeannie Mirror. Jeannie Mirror is president of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, a founding board member of the International Commission for Labor Rights, and she is also co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild's International Committee. She has been a member of the National Lawyers Guild for 42 years. She practices law, labor law, and employment and civil rights law in New York City, in the firm of Eisner and that last one was cut off. Myra. Okay. Jeannie Myra.
I was asked to speak about the relevance of the Rosenberg case to the current spate of post-9/11 terrorist cases. As Robert Miropol, I was 6 years old when Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed. Although I do not remember the trial or the demonstrations protesting their executions, my recollections of that period include hearing my mother cursing at the McCarthy, at Joe McCarthy every time he was on television, but then telling me not to repeat what she said to anyone. As a child, I was not aware that I was living through the McCarthy era, but I recall vividly the fear-mongering about secret communist cells, which were supposedly everywhere in the labor movement, even in the army, and that there were many dupes. My parents were New Deal liberals who abhorred what was going on, but the trial and execution of the Rosenbergs enhanced the fear of being labeled communist or fellow traveler and chilled their right to speak freely. Coming of age in the 1960s and the renewed hopes that the civil rights movements, the anti-war movements, the women's movements, I decided to become a lawyer to try to use legal skills in the interests of people. I was naturally drawn to the National Lawyers Guild. In 1969, I attended my first National Lawyers Guild conference in Columbia Law School, and it was called The Role of the Radical Lawyer. In this meeting, I first met Arthur Kanoy. And Arthur spoke about the work that he, Mike Curlin, Frank Donner, and others did in June of 1953 in the last-ditch attempt to stay the Rosenberg's execution after Emanuel Bloch reported that the stay that Justice William O. Douglas had issued against the execution was likely to be vacated by the full court. I want to read the speech he gave to us in 1969, which eventually became part of his book, Rights on Trial, because it is instructive for our time. That is, what he told us is important not only to understand the times, but also to underscore the need for people today to push back against the climate of fear that the war on terror has instilled in many. This is Arthur's story. Mike Perlin, I can't do a good Kanoy, but people remember. You know, Mike Perlin, Frank Donner, and I were working late on a Thursday evening in June in the small rooms of our converted New York apartment that served as our office when the telephone rang. The call was to have an effect on us from which, in a sense, we never recovered. When I picked up the phone, Emmanuel Block, the chief counsel for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, was on the other line from Washington. I had never heard anyone quite so distraught and upset as Manny Block sounded. He stuttered and blurted out, "They may vacate Douglas's stay. The execution may go forward ahead tomorrow night." He talked on and on about what happened. As he talked on, what happened became clear. All the Rosenbergs' formal appeals had been previously exhausted, and their executions had been set when 2 days before the scheduled executions, Justice William O. Douglas, in an act of judicial heroism, granted a stay until the new granted them a stay of execution until the new issues raised by their lawyers could be briefed and argued in the lower courts. All of us had breathed a sigh of relief when Justice Douglas signed the stay, because a week before that, the Supreme Court had adjourned for vacation and would not be back for business until this term opened in September. All was safe through the summer. Since the trial almost 2 years before, huge movements of support had developed for the Rosenbergs, demanding a halt to their executions. People had demonstrated in major cities throughout the world, insisting that the barbarism of the executions be stopped. Even the Pope had pleaded for the Rosenbergs' lives. The relief just granted by Justice Douglas seemed to be the answer to the world's demands. Now this new development that Manny Block was explaining to me threatened their lives again. The Chief Justice Fred Vinson had convened an emergency session of the entire court, calling them back from their vacations to consider overruling the stay of execution granted by Justice Douglas. Stunned, I could think of no other time, at no other time that such a thing had happened in the history of the court. Manny went on, in words I shall never forget. The court sits together at noon, sits again at noon tomorrow. Looks like they're definitely going to vacate Douglas's stay. Execution tomorrow. Do something. Figure something out. Get back to the Court of Appeals. Do something. We stayed up all night talking, pulling out books, poring over appeals papers that were in our office. By 3 a.m, we came up with an approach, a way to do something. We even got excited about it. It was the last resort plan of action. When the full court vacated Justice Douglas' stay the next morning, we would ask for another federal stay of execution by developing a variation on the approach that had captured Douglas's attention the week before. The act under which the Rosenbergs had been sentenced permitted the death penalty only in a time of war, but there was no declared war at the time of their alleged acts of espionage. Applying the death penalty at a time when the country was not actually at war thus might be challenged as unconstitutional without statutory authority. By 5 a.m, we had jammed out a set of federal habeas corpus papers which put forth the theory that the courts had no power under the statute to sentence the Rosenbergs to death. Then we started working on a plan of action to obtain a last-minute stay of execution that same day, pending full consideration of the new habeas corpus papers. The only way we could do this was by going back to the trial judge in the case, Irving Kaufman, and starting all over again. There was no hope of getting Kaufman to grant any relief, particularly in the, if the Supreme Court did not vacate Douglas's stay, for Kaufman's own reputation as a judge depended on the full vindication of the propriety of the death penalty he himself had mandated. But all we needed from Kaufman that morning was one word, denied, on the petition for stay of execution, so that we could present the emergency appeal to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. So now it was up to us. The fear and trepidation, Gruber, Perlin, and I walked down the corridor of the office of the Chief Judge of the Circuit, highly respected and conservative Judge Swan. To our surprise, we won a first important battle, getting past the bailiff in the outer office, and then the secretary by insisting we had a critically important paper to present to the Chief Judge. While we waited for the judge, Perlin put a call into Washington. The news, as expected, was that at noon, the full Supreme Court had vacated Douglas's stay, and the execution was now set for 8 that evening. What seemed like an hour of sitting in the reception room, looking at our watches every minute, and the knowledge that 8 o'clock was the outer limit, we were shown into Judge Swan's office. We quickly told him why we were there, and to our astonishment, he did not throw us out, as we expected. He looked at us and said, "All right, tell me what your theory is. Why should I grant a stay of these executions?" Then, with a faint smile, he added, "You've got a mighty heavy burden to carry. After all, the Supreme Court had vacated Douglas's stay." So Perlin, Gruber, and I sat there and laid out our theory, developing every point as we talked. Judge Swan picked up our papers. He mentioned several cases on which we were relying. We had mentioned several cases on which we were relying. He called in his clerk and asked for the volumes we had mentioned. He opened them up and leafed through them, and then it happened. He looked at it, and said, "You've got a point there. It makes some sense. I'll tell you what I'll do. I can't grant the stay by myself after the High Court has vacated Douglas' stay, but what I can do is convene a panel of this court this afternoon, two judges of the court and myself, to hear your application, and I'll vote for the stay. I'll convene the panel if you can get one other member of the court to agree to sit on a panel and consider granting the stay." That was beyond our wildest expectations. We blurted out, "Judge Swan, what other members of the court are around? Who can we get to see? Who is in New Haven?" He thought for a moment, and then he said, "Judge Frank. Judge Frank is here at his home." We sat stunned for a moment. He was sending us to Jerome Frank, the leading liberal judge on the court. Jerome Frank, the intellectual leader of the New Deal and architect of its most progressive legislation. Jerome Frank, the idol of young progressive law students and the leader of liberals when he taught at Yale, who had led the fight against conservatism and the old guard faculty by championing long before its actual victory, later the cause of clinical education in law school. We were going to see Jerome Frank. We stood up half dazed at this turn of events, scooped up our papers, and one of us turned to Judge Swan and asked, "What's the judge's address? What's Judge Frank's address?" The judge looked at us at his watch. It was about 2. He said, you don't have very much time." Then he picked up the telephone, called for the car assigned to him as chief judge to be brought around, and gave instructions that we be taken immediately to Frank's home. Things were moving in a way we'd never dreamed of. For the first time since Manny Block's phone call, the possibility of stopping the Rosenberg executions became real. Judge Frank was at his door to meet us. Swan had evidently alerted him that we were coming. He welcomed us in a friendly way, escorted us to his living room, and as we sat down in comfortable, easy chairs and nervously opened our briefcase to take out our paper, he smiled at us and looked for ways to put us at ease. The first thing he told us was that Judge Swan had called to say that an open telephone line had been established between the clerk's office in New Haven and Sing Sing and the New York State prison where the Rosenbergs were being held, because the federal authorities were borrowing its electric chair for that evening. We looked hastily at our watches. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. As Judge Frank saw us glance at time, he said, "All right, present your case." We argued as we had never argued in our lives. We put forward all the arguments. Then when we tried to cut short any point worrying about time, Judge Frank would interrupt and say, "No, develop that point. Lay it all out." Afterwards, he would say, "Fine, develop the next point." And we did. At last, we finished. We had been talking and arguing for more than an hour. We looked up at him, and he looked at us and was quiet for a moment. Then he said something I shall never forget. He said to us in soft, slow words, "If I were as young as you are, I would be sitting where you are now and saying and arguing what you are arguing. You are right to do so. But when you are old as I am, you will understand why," and he paused and he repeated, "why I cannot do what you ask. I cannot do it." We sat there stunned. This was Jerome Frank, the liberal. Jerome Frank, the progressive. We left without saying more than a formal goodbye to Judge Frank. Time was pressing furiously upon us, and we had only a few hours left to find another judge of the circuit.
Everything in Judge Frank's words and tone made it abundantly clear that he could not be moved from his position. He said nothing to us and would not look at us as we left. His back was turned. He just stood in the door motionless. Jerome Frank might, in a profound sense, have changed the course of American history that afternoon. He could not do it. He was a prisoner of the system he served. As a liberal, as a progressive, he had risen to a position of leadership in society. He would jeopardize the usefulness of those labels and accordingly the position they afforded him if he participated in the act of courage that Judge Swan, the conservative, was prepared to take. The labels, Frank's liberal past, imprisoned him, kept him from the course he would have taken if he were as young as we were, and we were as old as he was. He was telling us we would understand that to preserve our position in society, we must compromise with those in control. That was Arthur's story. It was abundantly clear to all of us who knew Arthur Kanoy and who were lucky enough, as I was, to be mentored by him, that he never did compromise with those in control, and that is a lesson we must bring forward today. In the Rosenberg case, the Espionage Act of 1917, which was upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court in 1919 in Schenck versus United States, was used to execute Julius and Ethel. But since the end of the McCarthy era and the beginning of the civil rights, anti-war, women's, and others' movements, there have been many government efforts to disrupt progressive movements and to use repressive measures like COINTELPRO. One of the areas where the National Lawyers Guild lawyers excel, COINTELPRO, to target civil rights and anti-war activists. Grand jury abuse then and now is legion. One of the areas where NLG lawyers excel is in fighting grand jury abuse. The National Lawyers Guild has often successfully thwarted grand jury indictments by advising those who are called to testify to refuse to cooperate. But the mere fact of being investigated is inherently chilling of people's actions and willingness to protest. 40 years ago, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers, he was tried for violation of the Espionage Act of 1917. His trial ended in a mistrial when it came to light that the White House plumbers had broken into his psychiatrist's office in an attempt to find negative information about him. Our dear friend, the late Len Wineglass, represented Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg spoke on television the other night in conjunction with the 40th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers and their declassification. And he noted that with the Patriot Act, now many of the illegal actions against him which were revealed and led to his mistrial are now legal. We need to address this terrible expansion of the national security state, which is the legacy of 9/11 and the perpetual war on terror. In 2001, the Cuban Five were tried and convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. And one of the five, Gerardo Hernandez, conspiracies commit murder in connection with the shootdown of the brothers to the rescue plane, which had been crossing Cuban airspace and dropping leaflets in Cuba, for which he was given 2 life sentences. Even though there was no evidence that any of them ever saw, let alone obtained classified information or knew of the shootdown, when the total reason for their presence in the U.S. was to gather evidence on the activities of extreme right-wing Cuban groups in Miami who were plotting terrorist acts against the island. Fighting for the release of the Cuban Five is difficult, as there has been almost a complete news blackout on the case, and every time the five are mentioned, they are referred to as Cuban spies. We are finding out more and more about the efforts of the government to prevent a change of venue and to pay for negative press stories about the case to prejudice the jury. And there is currently a new habeas petition pending. But today we are facing not only the use of the Espionage Act of 1917 being resurrected for WikiLeaks, about which I will mention more later, anti-war and other progressive movements are being threatened by allegations that they are materially supporting terrorism. Indeed, NLG sister Lynn Stewart was tried and convicted on the charges of obstructing justice and conspiracy to provide material support for terrorism when she violated the special administrative measures in place for the visitation of Sheikh Abdulrahman, who was convicted of plotting to blow up various targets in New York and whose case she was appealing. Whether you agree or not with Lynn's actions, the threat of being charged with material support of terrorism at this time is very real. That is, last year, the Supreme Court in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project found the law regarding support for designated foreign terrorist organizations to be constitutional. HLP versus Holder grew out of challenges to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which permits the Secretary of State to designate an organization as a foreign terrorist organization. ADPA, which it's called, also criminalizes knowingly providing material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization, including nonviolent activities of the organization. The challenge to the law claimed that it was unconstitutionally vague and that the Humanitarian Law Project sued because of its intent to provide advice and training to the Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK, on nonviolent dispute resolution techniques. The Supreme Court found such activity a violation of the law, and that even advice to these organizations is illegal and not a violation of the First Amendment. The decision was rendered in June of 2010. By September of 2010, the Joint Anti-Terrorism Task Force in Chicago sent FBI agents to search the homes of activists in Minneapolis and Chicago, most of whom are associated with a particular political party, and most of whom were active against the RNC in 2008. The agents took computers and many other pieces of personal property. Subpoenas to over 20 others to appear before a grand jury have been issued, and so far not one of the people subpoenaed has been willing to cooperate with the grand jury. Similarly, activists in many cities are being visited by the FBI and being rebuffed. The National Lawyers Guild has a Know Your Rights handbook, and advice is available through the NLG. It appears that one of the people who is being targeted had been at a peace conference in Columbia in the year 2000, where representatives of all the parties to the civil unrest, including the FARC, were present. Somehow, her attendance at this meeting is being considered giving material support to the FARC, which is named as a foreign terrorist organization. Similarly, another person is being targeted who is a leader of the Palestinian community. And while I do not know what he is being targeted for, he has traveled to Palestine and has probably met people on other listed foreign terrorist organizations. So far, there have been no indictments, but this case and this law are particularly troubling for people who engage in international solidarity work. As president of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, I travel the world meeting with colleagues who are struggling for peace and justice. Members of the National Lawyers Guild are also involved in significant international solidarity work. EDPA and the ruling in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project are extremely troubling because we cannot fail to support people who are fighting for their rights around the world. The last issue I want to raise is the case of WikiLeaks and the treatment of Bradley Manning and the possible indictment of Julian Assange. I'm a firm believer in transparency in government, and I believe that revealing information which exposes possible war crimes or illegal actions being covered up in diplomatic cables is not espionage. Information and documents may embarrass the U.S., but many of the documents so far leaked do not relate to our national defense and are not designed to injure the U.S. or advantage a foreign nation, as is required by the espionage before it is considered illegal. Although others disagree, the current grand jury has been impaneled to investigate those supporters of Bradley Manning, and that must be opposed, as well as the treatment of the torture that he is suffering. Indeed, yesterday, David House, a leader of Bradley Manning's support committee, refused to testify to the grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia. The relevance of the Rosenberg case today can be seen in an unbroken line of attempts to use laws of questionable constitutionality and breadth to chill the work of progressive activists and build a strong progressive movement. the McCarthy era and the fear that it engendered weakened the labor movement, as liberals in the labor movement and elsewhere had to buy into a Cold War mentality and, like Judge Frank, found themselves prisoners of the system that they served. The weakness in the labor movement has caused some of the major structural inequalities that have led to and perpetuate the current economic crisis, and which has led to the rise of right-wing and corporatist parties who called everything that is vaguely progressive socialist. In addition to demonizing socialists, the right promotes a climate of fear of terrorism and gets apoplectic when leaders have tried to classify terrorists as engaging in criminal acts, which must be investigated as any criminal case, and not as an international terrorist conspiracy, which must be the subject of perpetual war. We are told that there are secret sleeper cells of terrorists who are plotting to harm us every day. It is used to justify the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen, and the armed intervention in Libya. We must seek lessons from the past and not allow the repressive apparatus that now characterizes the national security state to deter our efforts to promote peace and justice. Only through speaking out and fighting back can we avoid becoming prisoners of the system ourselves. Thank you very much.